Welcome to another episode of the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast. I'm Brady, and I'm sharing my journey learning Bitcoin, hoping it makes yours a bit easier. So how's it going out there, Bitcoiners? Hope you all are doing fantastic today. Before we get started, I want to take a second to ask you to check out layer1btc.com for some great Bitcoin merch. Shout out to Nick Ward, who runs the show over there. He's a fantastic designer. He's got shirts, hats, hoodies, mugs, stickers, many designs to choose from. Great designs. Click on Partners at the top and choose Citizen Bitcoin to shop for merch that supports this podcast, including the Default Keynesian Recovery Center design. Bitcoin is teaching all of us default Keynesians what money really is, and that is nothing short of revolutionary in this day and age. So that's layer1btc.com, all spelled out. Go check it out. All right, let's do this. Steve Barber is the owner of Upstream Data in Canada, a company offering modular and portable Bitcoin mining hardware to the oil and gas industry in Canada. A lot of you will know him from Bitcoin Twitter. If you don't follow him already, you ought to. He's at SG Barber. Barber is spelled B-A-R-B-O-U-R. Steve and I discuss his background and the process of building Upstream Data, designing the line of Ohm mining products that allow oil and gas producers to capture the value of wasted energy as Bitcoin. We also discuss the broader mining industry and what Bitcoin has taught Steve over these last few years. Hope all of you enjoy this dive into the Bitcoin mining scene. Here we go. All right, I've got Steve Barber with me from Upstream Data in Canada. Welcome to the show, Steve. Thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me, Brady. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm excited to get into Bitcoin mining. It's a topic that we haven't dived into too much on the show. I did talk with Matt O'Dell a few months ago. We got into some Bitcoin mining talk, but it'll be fun to focus on it in this episode. Can we just get started hearing a bit about your background, how you got into the oil and gas industry, and then how you found Bitcoin and got into mining?
Yeah. I've done mechanical engineering in school, and when I graduated, I'm from Newfoundland, so I went to school in Newfoundland. When I graduated, I moved out to Alberta here on the west side of Canada, and Alberta being a big oil province, I got into the oil and gas with my first employer was Husky Energy. So that's how I started in the oil patch, and I was doing production and facilities engineering. I had a couple roles for Husky. I've always really been really interested in oil and gas production and, you know, like just sort of improving existing facilities and optimizing production, see how we get more oil out of the ground at a lower cost, that kind of thing. So I was there for about 5.5 years or so, really interested in that kind of stuff. Then I left Husky actually to start my own company. It wasn't nothing to do with Bitcoin. I still hadn't actually really heard of Bitcoin at this time. So I left them in around 2016-ish, sort of started my own company where I do like product design. So effectively what the plan was and what I ended up doing, what I still sort of do passively, but now it's on the back burner just because of this Bitcoin company. But I would basically go look at, you know, what products sell, what products are useful, what does everyone want in the oil field. Like mainly downhole tools I'm talking about. It's a lot of my expertise is in downhole stuff. So
what's downhole mean?
Downhole being like pumps. Like
literally just in the ground?
Yeah, like my primary specialty is progressing cavity pumps, like these rotary pumps that pump heavy oil from the ground. So basically like pump jacks, except instead of being a reciprocating pump, it's a rotary pump.
Gotcha.
Yeah, so and then all the tools associated with that pumping system is primarily what I specialize in. And, you know, like any industry, there's always room for improvement, right? So I'm looking at these tools and trying to figure out better ways of doing it. And so that's why I left my former employer, just because I couldn't really fulfill that. My job didn't really have much to do with like product design and that kind of thing. And that's what I really like doing. So that's what I was doing, or I still am sort of doing, but not really. I basically will find improvements to tools. Basically, the plan is effectively to patent improvements and then license them back to the manufacturers and that kind of thing, sort of have a passive income. It's a very good way to make a living, I think, for those of you who are, minded for innovating and product design and that kind of thing. But so I've been doing that. I actually have a few successful licenses ongoing, but
very nice.
In that time, so that's when I learned about Bitcoin. Like I started that company and I was working on these licenses, and I realized for the first time, I think it might have been like on Reddit. I can't remember where I, first saw some talking about Bitcoin. I had heard of it before, of course. I think a lot of people, 2013 timeframe, but I'd never put any time into it. And so that's when I started putting time into it. Just, okay, what is this thing? Like, it's still alive. Like, I got to see what this is all about, right?
Right.
So I just looked into it a bit, and obviously, like yourself and probably 99% of the listeners, it's just, there's so much about it that was just so intriguing. You just fall down that hole. So that's sort of how I got into it. What really drove me to get into it, though, was I just thought mining was unbelievable. I just thought it was crazy that, and I think maybe one of the first times that it sort of dawned on me, it was probably Andreas Antonopoulos' talk where he talked about, like Bitcoin mining as an arbitrage mechanism. And I think he referred to it, ideas like, doesn't matter what country you're in, doesn't matter where you're in the world, doesn't matter how remote you are, stranded energy, like if you have just low value electricity, if you can convert low value energy potential into electricity, well, you can get paid for it at the same cost anywhere else, right? Like 1 kilowatt hour in, Uganda is worth 1 kilowatt hour in Canada, right? So this was really, I just thought that was crazy, like mind boggling. And it was at that same time, like when I was learning about mining. The biggest problem, maybe not the biggest problem, but it's got to be up there in the oil industry is stranded natural gas, right? Like wasted gas. And that's really just a function of economics. Like the gas is so worthless or so low value that it just gets wasted, right?
So yeah, some well is producing at a rate that like just can't be used. And so it the market is just not like demanding enough gas at that point, or it's just like too costly to transport it, or like are those all reasons why, or there's probably other reasons too?
Oh yeah, I mean there's a few scenarios that you can end up having a waste stream, but like I'll give you one example, like this Texas install I did recently. They basically, first of all, if for anyone following the oil and gas industry, Texas in particular, with all the Permian activity, the shale gas, the fracking, they have a huge oversupply of gas. So it's been so bad this year that there's been several times where the actual gas prices, the Waha price, I think they call it down there, has gone negative. Like it's gone, like the producer, the person supplying the gas has to pay to get rid of it, which is sort of completely backwards, right?
Right.
So that's the severity of it. And I mean, that's just an indicator. Now that's basically a bottlenecked area. There's too much gas and there's not enough demand. So even like I wasn't in that area when we installed this Bitcoin miner over east of that area, but they didn't have negative prices, but they still had extremely low prices. So they ended up drilling for oil, missed it, but found a ton of gas, like some really good gas plays. But they have no, I think the cost of a pipeline and the infrastructure to get it into the sales line was over $8 million. And the payouts just weren't there. So, the only thing they could possibly do with that sunk capital is abandon it and basically let it, the capital is then sunk.
Right.
That's where, they're interested in Bitcoin mining, because you can just drop it on site. There's a pipeline required, right? So you just through the magic of the internet,
yeah.
You earn value. So that's like one example where you just have low value gas and it's remote. There's other cases so I live in Lloydminster, Alberta, and we're just straddling Saskatchewan as well. So in this whole area, we have all these oil wells. So they're pumping oil wells, but a byproduct of that oil production is gas. Sort of the same deal. Like, we can, we do, when it makes economic sense, we'll put in like a compressor and a pipeline and send it down the line to a sales line, or like even tie it into other wells and feed them as fuel gas. But more often than not, that's not feasible. You're just going to lose money on a project like that. So what they do is they just vent it straight out of the pipe, just straight into the atmosphere. The gas just streams out into the atmosphere.
Right.
And you're allowed to do that up to a certain amount. And beyond that, you have to flare it. So there's a couple cases I just, you know, talked about, but you know, there's a bunch more like reasons why these streams are wasted.
Yeah. Okay. So that makes sense. And it's fascinating. Like Andreas pointed out, in that video you mentioned, that the possibility for Bitcoin mining, and there's this talk, you know, all over the place that, that Bitcoin mining is wasteful. And, you know, there's all kinds of like, I've spent a lot of time on this podcast talking about energy FUD and how to refute it, because it's such a big one. And it's, you know, one of the top, the first or the second thing you're going to hear from somebody who's new to Bitcoin. The question you're going to get and the thing that they hear that sticks in their mind is Bitcoin mining is super wasteful. It's using, you know, this amount of electricity that, of entire countries, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And of course, like, you know, if there's a demand for it, then it's not a waste, I guess. I mean, Bitcoin mining still doesn't use as much electricity as like Christmas lights in the United States, for instance, right?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, like it's easy to make these comparisons. I just find it like I think the simplest. I mean, at least in my head. I mean, if someone's paying for something, like you can't really claim it's a waste. Like there's just no. I mean, paying for something implies you find it useful, right? We're Bitcoin miners are being paid by the economy of people using Bitcoin. So really, like it's like when people bring that up to me, I mean, I don't even get into all these. You can get into all kinds of different ways to refute it, but you know, like I don't know, like people, I don't pay for a Beyond Meat burger or something like that.
Yeah.
but it's not like it's useless to me, but it's not a waste. I mean, it's some other people. I find it a waste, but other people like it, right? Like, so it's not. I would never say that about something people are willing. Product people are willing to buy and find useful. So I mean, I don't know. Like it's that alone. You gotta have some like cognitive dissonance to sort of think that that's a logical argument. But then you have like companies like myself, like Upstream Data, but also even like most mining. I mean, there's been reports now. Like CoinShares has that report on a lot of mining is actually done off of surplus and otherwise curtailed renewable projects. So we're talking solar and wind. And primarily hydro. I mean, hydro, Bitcoin miners, as everyone knows, they flock to the hydro facilities and the hydropower. Half of that, like most, a lot of that electricity they're, you know, consuming is actually just would have been running down the river. So, you know, they had no demand. So that's another thing I tell people, like the amount of energy consumed by a Bitcoin miner, which we can pretty easily measure, or at least give a range, right? Last time I looked, it was between 3 and 5 gigawatts of like constant load on the network. So that is not strictly additive to the, you know, so people, like one of the common ones you see, I'm sure, is, you know, Bitcoin mining miners are consuming as much power as Ireland, and this is getting out of hand.
Right.
The oceans are going to boil. But it's not strictly additive. It's first of all, it's using up a lot of what is actually wasted. Or not generated because it's bypassed the generators, like the solar is curtailed and turned off, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's displacing. Like when you spend, and this is probably the argument I like the most. When you spend a dollar on something, that's you cannot spend that same dollar on something else. You know, and double spend it.
Right.
When you spend energy on something, when you dedicate energy to doing something, you cannot dedicate it towards something else. So the energy dedicated towards mining is not dedicated on whatever relatively useless crap that it would have been dedicated on. The miners are paying more money for it, therefore it's more useful. So,
right.
Yeah, I mean, there's a thousand ways to debunk that crap.
Yeah. And then the further point is, like the next layer that you can go to is that it's actually performing this really important function for the energy industry, right? And it's
definitely
in ways it's in. It's like you said, it's arbitraging energy across the world so that, more remote energy sources are then more viable because they have this other revenue stream that can support the infrastructure required to, or kind of offset the infrastructure costs, et cetera. And it's also in a kind of a roundabout way, incentivizing the use of renewables in that sense.
Yeah, I agree. So that's some good points. Like, I think that it's going to be really interesting to see over the next, you know, it's going to take time, but maybe let's say 20 years, how it changes energy infrastructure. Because, you know, like, I have no experience in large scale utilities, like in large scale power generation, but I can imagine, yeah, just being an engineer that, you know, they're probably designing these facilities, like they forecast what they expect the demand to be, and they over design the facilities so that it can handle, you know, a certain amount of peak load, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they have a plan for handling peak load. Well, now they can really, instead of over designing and having this, let's say like a generator that's normally running at, I don't know, 50% capacity for 90% of the time, just to service the 10% of the time where it peaks.
Right.
You can now really just design it for 100% load, run it, put all your surplus into Bitcoin mining. Like the utility, even if they were smart, they could, or at least they could work with manufacturers and just use it as a load bank. You just load up that generator, have it on a control system. As soon as the paying consumer, like you and I, who need the power at our house and we're willing to pay for it, as soon as we turn on the lights, well, they turn off the Bitcoin machines, right? Because we're paying more than the Bitcoin machines are. And that's the future I see. And and that's a much more efficient way of designing these systems. So I think that's, like you're saying, it's going to be a really, really good thing.
Yeah.
In terms of like, I do have some thoughts on the renewables. Like, I think that I agree with people when they say mining is a good tool for renewables. But at the same time, it's like a lot of these renewable projects, I guess we'll have to see in the future. But right now, a lot of them are heavily subsidized, and they're subsidized to service the grid. They're not subsidized to service the mining community. So it'd be curious to see what happens once these, like, because miners are going to come in and obviously snatch up this cheap excess and curtailed renewable power, that actually might have an effect on in the long term on how they're being subsidized, because I don't think the government and the state or whoever's subsidizing it is really interested in subsidizing Bitcoin miners, and that's actually what they're
right.
You know what,
yeah.
I mean? So yeah, there's so much cool stuff we're going to see.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it'll get profitable enough to mine Bitcoin that, you know, renewable energy producers will choose a Bitcoin subsidy over a government subsidy. I don't know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like with any Bitcoin business, I've been thinking about this lately as, you know, kind of thinking about this Bitcoin education industry that I'm, you know, trying to become a part of, and we're trying to build as demand for Bitcoin grows. There's going to be, you know, increasing demand for education about what the heck this thing is. And so when you're trying to find new customers, you've got to sell your product, but you've also got to sell Bitcoin.
Yep.
So when you go into the room and you've been invited to pitch your products for upstream to some oil and gas professionals, yep, or business, imagine that I'm, you know, somebody you're trying to pitch to. How do you sell Bitcoin to these people?
Yeah, no, great question. I mean, so first and foremost, like this has been a great learning process for me. You know, having a background in engineering and not really in sales, I've been learning what people really want to hear.
Yeah.
When I first started pitching, I was, you know, I spent a fair amount of time in the pitch talking about Bitcoin. Now, this was like the first time when I was first started pitching people and telling them about what we're doing and why it's so great for their facilities. This was probably like early 2017. And there's been a huge change between early 2017 and now. So that was just before the last big bull run, right? Most people I would talk to, and I wasn't going too hard on the sales pitching at the time because I was still trying to optimize the products and that kind of thing. But I was talking to people about it, and I would go to the occasional meeting to pitch it. And almost nobody really knew what Bitcoin was. Like, a lot of people like literally hadn't even heard of the word Bitcoin. So they weren't even as far as long as most of us were in maybe 2013. But so, I mean, I would get probably a little too much into how Bitcoin's so cool and how it worked. And part of it was a learning process for me because I was still learning how it worked. And I mean, I'm still learning how it works, but back then I was a little less polished, but I wasted a lot of time, I think, selling them on the concept of Bitcoin. And I think I probably changed a lot of minds, because some of the people that had heard of it, they bought into some of this FUD, like the energy waste FUD. But of course, like our products fly in the face of that. Now, so what I do nowadays, I no longer like, I don't even, first of all, there's been a change. Like most of these producers now have heard about Bitcoin, and actually a lot of them are starting to evaluate it as a solution for their facilities. Between our company getting the word out there and the news on us, and now there's other companies doing it, and a lot more talk in places like Calgary, which is sort of the oil and gas hub of Canada.
Okay.
So word has been spreading. So now what I do is I have one slide in my deck talking about Bitcoin. It's called like a compelling features of Bitcoin slide. So I literally, it's like at the end of the deck, I usually break it out for people that I feel like haven't really thought much about Bitcoin, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But there's some really high level things in there. I don't ever bother explaining how it works to people anymore unless they want to hear it. And I guess I'm just learning that, you know, when you get into the sales side of things, people don't really think like engineers. They don't really care about the inner workings. They just want to know, okay, it works. It seems pretty cool. Okay, how much money am I going to make? You know, so.
That makes sense to keep it simple. Then do you often get like follow-up questions? Are people intrigued by it?
Yeah.
Or is it like what percentage of people usually like ask for more, details about Bitcoin?
I would say at least 50% of people want to get right in my head and understand how does it work. Because it's sort of mind-boggling when you get into it, how it all works.
Mm-hmm. The mind virus.
Yeah, and they want to understand it, and it's a lot easier talking to someone like me who's in the industry a bit and can explain it a bit better than them having to do all their own research. But I mean, I still keep it high level. I never go too detailed.
Right.
But then there's like, I would say 5% of people will come out and still be extremely, they think it's a scam. Like they just think it's like a fad. They don't think it's anything of substance. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Right. Because it's digital.
Yeah. It's not as great as their, it's not in their bank account. I can't spend it anywhere. Like, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
The classic arguments, but, yeah. And then the most people are just, that's pretty cool. They're not that interested, but they're interested in the facility stuff that we talk about.
Right on. So how does this process work then when you install a product into the field for a customer? How does the mining work? Are you actually like operating the rigs, the mining rigs, and how do you share?
Yeah.
The Bitcoin, do they usually just want to get paid in fiat? How does that whole process work?
And I tell people this all the time, like Upstream Data, like my company and our product and service, we're a service provider, like first and foremost.
Okay.
We don't operate the same as like traditional Bitcoin miners where, we're trying to get a facility and do all the mining ourselves. We're actually just trying to offer product and a service to the oil company, because the reason for that is there's a lot of reasons, but one of them is that they benefit the most from our service. When they get venting this gas and they're not actually allowed to vent it, it's over the regulatory limitations. Well, they're getting a huge financial benefit from us coming in and mm-hmm. getting rid of it. So we exist as a service provider. And so what we try to do is build and sell product to them. And we've been getting more success with that recently, just because,
right.
The awareness keeps going up, like of Bitcoin, and people are starting to understand it. It's becoming less of a, let's call it a risk. And also there's been a lot of really good news on our company releases. So they now see us, like maybe a year ago, when I was first pitching this stuff, they might have saw it as more of a, okay, this guy's, there's an opportunity here. He's just jumping on it. But we don't know like how legit they are. I'm just guessing that might be what they're thinking, but now there's been a lot more substantial news on us. So they're like, okay, these guys are actually legitimate. They have a bunch of installations that are working and making money that we can reference, right?
Right.
So I basically, just to go a little further, like, we'll build and sell data centers. We have clients that bought them and they're operating them themselves. We will take on third parties, operate. So let's say, like, we'll sell a data center to a third party and operate on their behalf. Our service is to maintain the data center, make sure it's just like, it's basically hosting, but I'm hosting the entire data center and miners and a genset. So we do that, and we also, but our primary objective is to sell these things to oil companies, and you know, we'll operate them if they want us to, or if they have their own IT guys. Like, everything we design is meant to be ease of use, like low barrier to entry to the producer. In terms of operating this thing, it's quite easy. That's where my facilities and production experience come in. Like, I build all this operator-friendly functionality into everything so that they're not intimidated by it. And their field guy, who has no idea how to even run Windows, can basically operate the thing successfully with just maybe a little bit of assistance from either us or their IT people, whoever they want to actually manage the ASICs. But otherwise, like, the facility side of it, like what's going on in the power distribution, what's going on with the engine and the genset, they're quite comfortable with that, right? So,
yeah. So in the product, inside the product itself, you have the miners separated from the, like, the engines that are accepting the gas and producing the electricity. So if there's maintenance need to be done, like, you just open one side to kind of work on the engine side, and open the other side to work on the computing side, mining side?
Yeah, pretty much. Like, we have two products out there now. So the one that you're referring to is the Ohm combo unit.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the unit with the combination genset and data center.
Okay.
So yes, you're basically right. Like, in one side of it, you have a genset. It's open to anyone to walk in, and, you know, it's for the operator to walk in and check and stuff. And then on the other side is the data center, which is locked off. You can't really get in there without access. So depending on who owns the data center, if it's our data center, we don't give that access away.
Mm-hmm.
If it's their data center, then they get the key. But otherwise, some of these mines that we got out there, some of these data centers, like, I haven't been there. Like, no one from upstream has been there in, like, months, like probably 4 months for the longest one since I visited. Because I can do everything remotely, like even ASIC restarts, like hard circuit restarts, we can do remotely.
Oh, nice.
And they're automated. Yeah, I mean, I build in, it depends on what the operator needs. Like, if the guy has a really reliable fuel source and there's no chance the engine getting knocked down on low fuel or overloaded because, for example, it's running another prime mover, like it's running a hydraulic pump or something that's running a well site. Then it's automated so that, you know, it never knocks down that engine, and it'll drop the mining load. It's watching the engine. So basically, the engine starts sagging due to an overload situation or a lack of fuel. It'll drop the mining load to free up power. So we basically build it to accommodate what they need. But if it's like a gas well and you're never going to have fluctuating volumes, I mean, the difference here, I'm just saying, like, a gas well is pure gas. The oil well could be spitting gas. Like, it might not be consistent. For the gas well, you don't need the entire control system if you don't want it. But it's nice to have because it enables us to never have to go off-site. So I can pretty much scale up to many, many data centers with minimal personnel kind of thing.
Awesome. So you operate them remotely. I guess you have some kind of cell connection, cellular modem attached to the units. And
yep.
Then you, like, the mining, let's say, do you usually just attach these miners to a pool?
Yeah, we just do pool mining.
Can you explain how pool mining works?
Effectively, there's a central server. Like, basically all the, okay, I mean, pools came to be pretty early in Bitcoin. It might have been 2011. I think Slushpool might have been the first one, but they developed the Stratum protocol so that, you know, instead of everyone solo mining on full nodes, you could have someone host a full mining node as a server and basically divvy out work to miners who are not mining on their own full nodes. So basically that's what we're doing. Like, I have clients that are on slush. There's a few different pools we're on, depending on client, but we're sending basically our work to the central server. They're doing all the, you know, transaction ordering, full node software and that kind of thing. But it's nice for us because, especially when you're in these remote sites, you want to be well connected with low latency. There's a bit more latency in a cell network than, I don't know, fiber network. So latency and then bandwidth, like we don't want to use very much bandwidth just because cellular billing, right? Like we want to keep it low. So
right. There's
like a lot of reasons why we would continue to do a pool mining, even if in these remote locations rather than, you know, solo mining or something.
Right. So then you get a payout relative to your portion of work done in the pool. So whatever the pool collects, then it just divvies everything up among all the pool participants.
Yeah, you know, the pool, you get a slice of the pie. So, I mean, if you're doing 10% of the work, you have 10% of the hash power on the pool, then you'll get 10% of the pie minus whatever the pool fee happens to be. So, I mean, the bigger the pool, the more often you find blocks, and then you obviously get paid when you find a block. So it depends on your sort of time preference. Like if you're okay with only getting paid once a month, well, there's small pools with lower fees that you could go to. I mean, I would always recommend that for small miners, but bigger pools like Slush Pool is nice for people that, I mean, higher fees, but it's still a really nice pool to mine for.
You get more consistent payouts because the pool is larger.
Yeah.
They're discovering blocks more consistently.
Yeah, many blocks a day, and you're gonna get paid off more frequently if you want. I mean, it depends on your level of Slush Pool, for example. They're effectively a trusted third party holding your Bitcoin.
Right.
So you want to not leave too much coin on that at any given time.
Just like pay out, just like it's an exchange. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Number one rule, man: don't leave your Bitcoin with someone else.
That's right. Not your keys, not your coins. So then you would collect, like, let's say if you have a service contract with a customer, you would then basically, you would sell that Bitcoin on an exchange and then send fiat to them as per your arrangements, you know, minus your fees.
If I'm on a produced well site, would I?
Yeah.
So, let's say that the newest product it got that we were talking before we went live. So that was bought and is paid for and is owned by an oil company. I facilitate their mining. I just do that for a very small fee because they have no experience.
Right.
But they own all the Bitcoin. It's in their custody.
Okay.
And that's one thing, you know,
yeah.
we do not do custody. So it's in their custody. If they want, I usually, you know, I give out free advice. I mean, I give that out anyway, whether or not you're my client. So if they want, you know, assistance in liquidating that, you know, I can help facilitate it for them. But usually I express to them, like, you know, if you're getting into this, you should dedicate some resources to figuring out a plan, like a strategy on how you want to, you know, run this side of your business, right? So realistically, like I don't really have any scenarios where I do any selling of coin or liquidating on behalf of a client.
Yeah, right.
And I don't want to. So let them deal with their own coin. So
you just basically set them up with their own like pool accounts, and you never have to worry about touching their Bitcoin. They have it sent directly to them.
Yeah, exactly. Like I don't want to see. I don't want to understand where they're even holding their wallet. I mean, you know, I'm here to help them, but I stay away from that because it's a risky business because if they ever got hacked and, I don't know, I was somehow involved in setting up their wallet, well, they're going to wonder, and I don't want people to wonder, so I stay far, far away from that. But what I will do is, you know, we have software, I can log in and VPN into their network and assist with mining optimization, all the networking and configuration side of stuff, which is, at the end of the day, we're talking like not very difficult. Any miner listening right now knows what I'm talking about. It's not rocket science. So I'll facilitate that for them if they want me to. I mean, if it's their asset, if it's my asset, of course I do it. But if it's their asset, it's if they want us to, we'll do it. We usually do also provide like network data fees, like cellular fees as part of the ongoing service.
So besides mining, like as you were getting into Bitcoin, you went down the rabbit hole, you're learning about it. What surprised you, or you know, what did Bitcoin teach you, I guess, as you were learning about it? Besides, you know, obviously the mining intrigued you, but any other aspects of Bitcoin that you learned or discovered that surprised you?
Oh man, that's a good question. I would say I learned that Bitcoin is one of the few truths in a world of fake like stuff. I sometimes joke, like, you know, we live in a world of fake news, mm-hmm. like fake people, fake food. You know, like Bitcoin's taught me a hell of a lot. Like, honestly, you know, I think I don't know where you found me. Maybe you found me on Twitter.
Yeah.
It's not that Bitcoin has taught me a lot. It's the people that are attracted to Bitcoin have taught me a lot. There's all kinds of people that have just completely changed my view on the world, like, or how I understand the world. Like, I mean, a couple of them, like Safe Dean, of course, with his economic theory ideas, like these Austrian ideas that everyone seems to love. Eric Voskuhl, it's really challenged what I understand, and I've learned a lot from his writings. And then, like, I could name 1,000 people, like, in the Bitcoin Twitter sphere. But I would say that, you know, Bitcoin really is just it's about the people, and I think it's the people that the economy of people that use it. It seems to reward. I've said it before, like. Bitcoin, it seems to reward honesty, like it, and that's sort of fundamental to mining. Like dishonest miners lose money, right? And I think there's some kind of like link there where even people that FUD against Bitcoin, they lose their reputation, right? Like if you say stuff about Bitcoin, okay, it's not, you know, you're attacking it all the time. It's not scalable. Like you're shitting on it. You're forking it. Well, you know, like. If your ideas don't end up being right, you end up, your reputation gets trashed. And you see that a lot. Like, there's a lot of people who FUDded against Bitcoin for so long, and they just continuously just trash their reputation. And I think, like, we're coming out of a era where reputation was meaningless. Whatever happens, let's say, with my company, whatever happens, anything I do, if I hold a strong reputation and make a good name, myself, like that'll pay off in the future, because I think more than ever reputation is important. And I'll just give you an anecdote in terms of like in the mining business, and a lot of guys listening probably know this, scamming's happening all the time. You buy a batch of ASICs, they never show up, right? Like they never actually got manufactured. That's happened a lot in the past. Buy a bunch of used ASICs, they don't work. You know, you trust someone, send them Bitcoin, they steal your money. So it's such a crazy wild west of a space, especially this mining space, the whole Bitcoin space in general, but mining in particular. Building a reputation is a huge deal. Like, people will, like, I'm slowly growing a network of people that I trust and hopefully trust me, so that we can trade amongst each other and have. You know, I can help, and a third party who I don't really know well, like, they know they can trust me, so I at least can be an anchor in terms of even if it's something like facilitating getting them a few ASICs, like that kind of thing.
Yeah, and the mining industry is just insanely competitive. It's like it's almost perfectly competitive, just because there's, you know, there's right, there's one, there are two basic inputs. You know, you have your equipment and then electricity. And yeah, it's
plug a computer in the wall and you're done.
Like, yeah.
it's the easiest industry in the world to get into, like, you know,
right. But it's also really difficult to actually be profitable.
Yes,
in, right.
It's super easy to get into. Anyone can do it. I mean, you do have to be willing to make the investment. Like, ASICs aren't free. But anyone can do it. There's practically no barrier to entry. You just have to spend a few minutes learning how to configure the miner once you plug it in, and understand a little bit about your electrical distribution system to make sure you don't burn your house down, right?
Right.
So, but that's how easy it is to get into it. Now, of course, it's very difficult to make a profit. That's why, you know, it's for that reason that it seems like there's a lot of people that do get into it because it is so easy and it seems like such an easy win. And when you, when you look at the, you know, if you have $100,000, right, and you want to get into mining in it, in this medium way, like not really a big way, but a medium way, you can spend all that money on ASICs and you might make a really great return on investment in 2 years. Like in terms of, you might, by the time you calculate your coins value in 2 years, you might have $300,000. You might have tripled your money, but you might have still lost actually, because you could have just used that $100,000 to buy Bitcoin. And so that's what a lot of new miners, especially the smaller guys, they make that mistake. They think that 6 cents per kilowatt hour is a good price, like for power. And then they find, oh, wait, there's more fees on top of that. Yeah. Or even if they have 6 cents, like you're not going to last in a bear market at that power cost. So it might have been a good price in the past, but with ASICs, you know, getting so commoditized and easier to get, the power needs to be lower and lower. So yeah, you're right in that it's competitive and hard to do successfully.
Insanely competitive. So if you're a miner, what do you need to think about? Obviously, the price of electricity is critical, but you also have to think about the efficiency of your miners, right? And the cost of the equipment. And that's also changing. So what are some of the calculations that you have to do on a regular basis to be a profitable miner?
Well, you know, I'm off-grid miner. I don't mine on the grid, but I think like for the guys that are on the grid, and this might apply to some like residential miners who might even have to power just commercial scale. You know, there's peak hours. Like, of course, they have to consider is the electricity change in costs like over the time of the day or the days of the week. They have to take that into account because sometimes you might have to shut down periodically.
Okay.
So you avoid like the super high cost power time, the peak hours. I mean, once I make an investment in a rig, get a mine up and running, it's really just about uptime. Like I just got to keep this thing up as long as I can. Otherwise it's not making any money, of course. So uptime. And then of course I have other things to consider, like got to make sure my gen sets are maintained. But you know, it's really not a ton to it. It's really about the upfront. You have, before you make the investment, you really have to do your homework. And I mean, just a good rule of thumb is if you don't have, I wouldn't even think about it if I didn't have 4 cents or less power cost.
Okay.
Because part of the problem is that you can get good deals on used equipment, the older stuff like S9s, you can get really good deals on it. And that's a good avenue to be getting into mining, is to buy the used stuff. But that's only if you have super cheap power that you can afford to run it. When it comes to the new stuff, they price it so high, and especially nowadays with so much more demand and people snatching up ASICs just to not even mine with them, just to resell it. I mean, you have to buy from the manufacturer on new equipment pretty much. Otherwise, you're paying an even higher jacked up price. But even when you pay for the manufacturer, they price it in such a way that the payout, it's quite a while. Like you don't make the Bitcoin back you paid for usually like 280 plus days. So you got to be, and then you have failures. Like when you buy ASICs, they're not all going to work perfectly. Like, I don't know if it's the same because I haven't bought any new stuff recently, but like Bitmain, if you had 5% or less like board failures, made a new order, that was good. Like there's guys, you know, getting 15, 20% board failure.
Wow.
So you got to account for all this stuff when you do your economics. And a lot of people say this, and I agree. If you don't have some kind of real competitive advantage, then you shouldn't be getting into it. You should just buy Bitcoin. That's really all you got to do, and you'll have the Bitcoin. And at the end of the day, all we're all trying to do is stack sats. Like we're trying to get more coin. You got to figure out how are you going to maximize your sats, and your fiat money is going to run out once you clean it cleaning being, you know, get rid of that crap. get your coin. I don't mean like launder it. I just mean get rid of that garbage. But
yeah.
once you run out of fiat, now you have a stack of sats, and it's incredibly difficult to use your satoshis to buy ASICs, which are a depreciating asset, and get more satoshis. Like, you have to have a huge advantage, like close to free power or close to a manufacturer who's giving you a really, really good price.
Yeah. So, I mean, how much of a profit can a miner who's doing a good job, how much profit in sats can someone expect to make? I mean, you have to sell most of that off to pay for electricity and equipment, right?
Yeah. I mean, the equipment, you definitely have to sell a fair amount of it. And that the amount you have to sell, of course, is a function of your operating cost. I don't really have a good answer to that. Like, I wouldn't be mining myself, even with free power, if I wasn't providing a service for oil companies. Like, if I didn't think that I could get this business to the point where they're buying my units, and we actually have a growing business with solving a problem in the oil industry, I wouldn't be doing it, because I would be probably better off, like, for me just to mine myself on oil wells, I would be better off taking the capital. We're talking about more capital than a typical Bitcoin mine. I mean, I got a genset I got to pay for. I have a smaller economy of scale, right? I'm not building a 10 megawatt data center. I'm building my biggest one now is, that's coming out later in the year, will be a 1 megawatt, but still, I'm not getting the economies of scale of a large scale operation. So I would probably, if I didn't think that I was solving a problem for people and they're going to want my service and pay me for the service, I wouldn't be doing this business, and I would probably just be buying Bitcoin.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, you're motivated because you want to help the industry progress, and I mean, both the oil and gas industry and the Bitcoin industry.
Yeah. And the theme of that is just, if you really have to have a monstrous advantage to get into this mining thing, because the manufacturers have that advantage, and they don't give it to you because they price it in such a way that effectively I have close to free power to make a run of it. Like in the 3 maybe 4 cents is good enough. I don't know what the threshold is. I don't really need to worry about that, but it's around that 3 to 4 cents I would want to do it unless I was down there.
Yeah. So, I mean, speaking of the manufacturers, what's this, like, the latest on Bitmain? I haven't really been keeping up much with them, and I assume you probably followed their actions and, like, you know, whatever, that followed the company pretty closely over the years. Could you give us, like, a kind of a summary of the what happened with Bitmain, the kind of saga of Bitmain over the past few years?
Yeah. I'm not a Bitcoin or Bitmain hater, first of all. I don't hate them. I do consider them a bit of a bad actor. I'll talk about some stuff, but I'm not a hater of Bitmain. I buy Bitmain's equipment. I'm happy that Bitmain exists because it's helped my business. But they're a bit of a bad actor. I guess the first fun thing about Bitmain is there's a lot of things, but the first fun thing is, like, their whole backing of Bitcoin Cash,
right?
And this fork of Bitcoin. And, you know, I personally have never really cared or faulted them for that. I always just thought it was a really bad business decision.
Yeah.
For a few reasons, though. Like, it's one thing to start accumulating all this fork coin that, you know, you're just, you know, they're trying to pump to make it something substantial, to make it, like, I don't know, a thing. But besides, I'm not really going to get into what I think of Bcash right now, But Bitmain, like, so they only would accept, like, BCH for payment. I mean, as a guy mining Bitcoin, like, that, you're doing a disservice to your customer, right? They're building Bitcoin ASICs, and they won't accept the Bitcoin, right? Like, if I wanted to pay them. So that was a huge pain in the butt, and I thought a disservice to their customer base doing that. So that was one screw up. Obviously, the big screw up with that whole saga is the fact that they did accept so much BCH, and they did support it so much that they're left with a monster bag. And if Bitcoin Cash doesn't If it doesn't outperform Bitcoin, then they've suffered a massive opportunity cost, right? Because they could have just got Bitcoin. So that's one thing. Then they've been bad actors.
It must be the biggest shitcoin bag of all time.
Oh, no doubt. The Bitmain holding. It is. Yeah, it is. And I mean, like, I don't see the use case for Bitcoin Cash. But that's aside from that, like Bitmain, they've done some other things. Like they've had backdoors in their ASICs that was sort of revealed their ant bleed about a year and a half ago or whatever, and that was a bit of a big deal. So that's a huge security issue and like network security. I mean, these are things that like, you know, this is what I'm talking about earlier, like being dishonest and being like, they've trashed the reputation. And of course, I think it's hurt them now because they were trying to raise some money.
Yeah. They were trying to IPO, right?
Yeah. And I'm just like you and everyone else. I have no inside information, but you know, there's that guy leaking information about what was going on. And if that's all true, then they're acting pretty shadily. And that's like a horrible, I just think Bitmain's reputation is forever tarnished, and them as a company will forever have to pay that debt, even, you know, assuming they survive. So, and aside from that, like, they're not very open with the mining community on their firmware and giving access to the firmware. Like, they're violating copyright licenses. I think, I don't know it in that much depth, but I have talked to some core developers who talked about it. How they're using firmware that has open source licensing or whatever that's called, where you know they're not supposed to be able to. It's got to be open source, right? So it's not. So
right. It's like So like if they use open source software, then they need to open source the product, right? Of that of whatever they change or something.
Yeah. Part of that open source licensing.
MIT license.
Yeah, and they're not doing that. And I mean, they've just been, you know, they've done a lot of things. They just came out with firmware, for example, May, that allows you to boost your hash rate and, like, basically, you know, overclock and underclock your ASICs.
Okay.
And we all know that they could have done that from the very start, like, given that service to their customer, but they didn't do it. And we all know that they had ASIC boost capability, like, covert built into their stuff, as well as the ability to do overt ASIC boost. And they don't do anything for their customers. So that's all I'll say about Bitmain. I think they're a bit of a bad actor, although I don't hate them. And I still buy the product.
Right on. Well, what's the state of the ASIC industry aside from Bitmain? Has their kind of, I guess, reputation hit opened up opportunity for other producers?
Yeah. I think the ASIC industry is very healthy right now. At least compared, I mean, I think it's just getting better and better and healthier. And I expect the quality and reliability of the product will continue to improve. But especially when you think about what has happened historically. But I mean, like, Bitmain was the first company to really mass produce a really great ASIC. And then, and because of that, like the S9 mainly and the S7, but primarily the S9, like, they've had a huge market share. But I understand, like, a lot of really great people at Bitmain that got them there left the company and started other companies. So I know there's Ebang out there, which doesn't seem to service North America very well, but they make pretty good ASICs. Watts Miner, of course, is great. They have great product. As far as I know, I haven't heard anything bad about Watts Miner yet. In terms of, you know, even quality, obviously very important, but customer service, I haven't heard anything bad about them. So, and then there's like Avalon. I haven't used their stuff, but I haven't heard much bad about them. A little, but mostly good. So, I mean, there's multiple manufacturers now, and there's rumors that, I mean, Samsung makes chips for a lot of these guys, but I heard a rumor that they're possibly coming out with an ASIC, their brand or not. But so it's getting more competitive, and it's always been getting more competitive. There's been a misunderstanding, I think, by some people that mining is getting more and more centralized. But I think all the signs are showing that it's not. It's getting more decentralized, and seeing manufacturing get more competitive is going to be great. And I think that's just the way, it's just natural. You're going to see like really great engineers split off from the company and start their own company. It's sort of what I was doing with Husky. I was trying to develop stuff, and I wasn't able to do it the way they weren't allowing me to do what I wanted, so I just left. I mean, that's why you're going to see with these ASIC guys. It's great.
Awesome. That makes good sense. And it's good to hear that you think that we're sort of moving toward a more decentralized mining system. Have you looked much into Matt Carello's BetterHash proposal?
I haven't looked a ton into it. I like the concept. Like, I think it's a net benefit for sure. Yeah.
It makes sense to you?
Yeah, I wouldn't even be able to explain it in detail. Like, if you asked me to explain it to everybody, I wouldn't be able to explain it to detail. I know that it's more about taking the transaction ordering away from the pool operator and giving it to the successful miner who finds a block, which is great. I think that's a good thing. But the pool operator, of course, still needs to divvy out shares and who's
going to work. Right.
And so it's splitting out some of the responsibility from the pool operator to the miner, which I think is really good. I actually was just reading this morning. So at that Mining Disrupt conference, I wish I was there. I'm sort of got the FOMO over that, but I have only been to one mining conference, but that was one I definitely wanted to be at. The guys at Slushpool, a bunch of great guys over there, they released some information about, and I was just reading it this morning. It's talking about they were inspired by BetterHash, and they're doing something very, very similar, but they actually have a bunch of other improvements, like the actual Stratum protocol. They call it version 2. And I think maybe those are the guys that actually developed Stratum in the first place, but anyway, it doesn't matter. So that's something some of you listeners can go check out. I'm going to be reading more about it and seeing if it's good to implement in my operation. I think it might be because they're talking about lower bandwidth consumption and that kind of thing, which is important for, you know, cell networks.
Awesome. All right. This has been really fun to talk about and just catch up on what's going on in the mining scene. It's something that I don't follow as closely because I'm mostly focused on, you know, code stuff, tech stuff, and then the economics side of Bitcoin. And so I have a lot more to learn on the mining side, and it's, you know, I need to dive more into it. I would love to try it out, actually get an ASIC and try it out. But I've been really intimidated by the thought of that. And like you said, you know, it's super competitive, and unless you have like a major advantage, it's not really worth the time. I think just from an educational perspective, just the experience would be maybe worthwhile, since I'm, you know, interested in just like learning about Bitcoin. Just doing it is the best way to learn, I think. If I just wanted to do it sort of not looking to make a profit, just to kind of help the network and help me learn about how mining works, what should I, like, what are the resources I can look at that you would recommend,
Yep.
For someone that way? Yeah.
Well, yeah. First of all, definitely. I mean, I think it is a great thing to go. A guy should go get a used ASIC and just for fun and to learn. Even if it's in your garage and you have high power costs, just for a bit of fun. But if you're going to do it that way, I would probably recommend you go get a stick miner, because if it's really an educational thing, a stick miner will do you just fine. Like, you learn the same stuff.
Right.
And that doesn't sound as exciting because, you know, we're talking about a USB stick miner. But they're sort of cool, actually. There's these Gecko Science ones. These guys just... So I guess a good resource to go, and this is where you'd find these stick miners, is on like just the Bitcoin Talk forum. That place is still pretty active, and there's a lot of great community there that will help you. And I mean, there's already so much on the forum of people learning in the past, so you probably don't even need to ask any questions. Just go do some research there. But a good way to start is, and to get into it, I would even just, that's what I did. The first thing I bought was an S9 in 2016, and I put it in my garage because I, you know, wanting to start a business around this, I got to at least get your toes wet before you go large scale, right? So yeah, I do that, like go get an S9, like used S9 the option. If you want to actually mine and make a tiny bit of money, you'll probably still actually make a profit in your garage. You just won't make as much if you just spend on Bitcoin.
Right.
Still, it's not the end of the world. Yeah.
Right. Cost of education. I'd never seen these USB sticks before or heard of them. I'm looking at them right now. I'm looking at the Gecko Science
The Gecko Science ones are pretty cool. Like, you can overclock them. It's a cool little community. I mean, it's we're talking hobby, right? Like, but
yeah,
these guys like, well, some guys have like, you know, 50, and they'll have like a few just fans just blowing over them to keep them cool.
Yeah,
like USB hub and stuff. But I think it's cool. Like, it's not something you would do. I bought one literally just to have one, and I, you know, just learned CG and see what how it worked, and just to have it, a collector's item. That kind of thing.
Right.
You can get other ones that are. Oh, sorry. Yeah. You can get some other ones that are really cheap, like sort of cheap looking, like they're just sort of lame. But those Gecko signs.
Yeah, they do look pretty rad. They got this kind of like, you know, the open circuit board and the heat sink on there and stuff. Yeah. This looks like a good solution for someone who just wants to like get the experience of Bitcoin mining and attached to a pool and just see how it all works. Pretty cool. Looks like they're sold out right now, unfortunately, but I will put some of these links in the show notes for listeners who might be interested in doing the same. I'm all about the hobbyists. I got a bunch of nodes running at home now and Raspberry Pi setups and got a Casa node and a Noddle and just want to test all that hardware out. So this is a great next rabbit hole to dive down into. I'm excited. Very cool. Yeah, I think this is a good place to wrap things up. How can people follow you, I guess, on Twitter? And do you have a website for Upstream?
Yeah, definitely follow me on Twitter. You know, you'll suffer a major opportunity cost if you don't. So at SG Barbour, BARBOUR. And then in terms of website, upstreamdata.ca.
All right, man. Really appreciate your time, Steve. Keep up the great work up there in Canada, and best of luck to your business.
Yeah, thanks, Brady. Thanks for having me.
What did you all think of that discussion? What's your take on the state of the Bitcoin mining industry? Are you interested in learning more about it? I know I am. Let Steve and I know your thoughts and questions on Twitter. Steve is at SG Barbour, at SG BARBOUR. And I am at Citizen Bitcoin. If you appreciate the podcast, you can give back, help me bootstrap this thing by sharing the episode with your friends and family and on Bitcoin Twitter, or leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Appreciate all your support so much. That's it for this one. Take care out there, Bitcoiners, wherever you happen to be in the world.